Hey there, I'm PK and...
I'm Tom, and this week we've come together in the flesh.
Yeah, so the Ecocentrics have been invited to the amazing Potty Plotters allotment.
So we've come all the way across the country, at least 20 minutes, from Stoke to Derby.
We're with Elaine and Julia, who are the amazing hosts of the Potty Plotters, and we have been so lucky. We are sitting in the middle of what they, quote, call their beer garden. Thus far, we're having tea and squash, but it's an amazing, glorious allotment.
And you've already shown us a few of the things around the plot, and I think you two are living and breathing the environmental dream at the moment, so it'd be good to hear about some of the things that you're doing and see in practice what it's like to be here.
I think that everything's hard work, but if it is that you want it to work, you can make it happen.
And I think you guys have done a great job of showing how what we like to say is the eco way of doing it, where you don't have to add lots of chemicals that you buy at a store.
No.
You can just use what you've got on your land, grow what grows in your environment, harvest the water, use what you've got to help be the nutrients and to put back into the ground. And we think it's just a fantastic eco-centric way of growing food.
Maybe the way that we need to deal with this is to educate people, because it's simple, but it's much easier to go and get your chemicals. So if it is that everybody got a Bill the Muck Man on their doorstep, and we told people about how good having your own muck delivered to your plot or your garden is, or comfrey. Or
yes.
Nettles.
Yes, yes. You like to make a smelly brew occasionally, don't you?
I don't mind making it smell wherever I go. But it does make a big difference. You don't have to pay for it. It just lands and we keep it, including smells.
So, can you tell us a bit about what we're going to see on this tour around the allotment today?
You're going to see lots of vegetables, lots of flowers, lots of fruit crops. We've got lots of bushes. We've got lots of trees.
And food. Food, because I look at things and think food. You see, we've got dahlias in front of us.
Oh, yes.
And they're edible.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So
yeah.
What we could do is just talk to you about how to eat them and when to eat them. And you're going to take those home with you. So there's lots of things that perhaps other people don't know that you can do that actually they don't do it because they don't know. And you don't know what you don't know till you do.
This is exciting here. Ready to eat some flowers.
I'm so excited.
Don't believe she won't make you, because the amount of flowers that I've ate, very trusting, actually. I'm the trusting one, the one who always has to go up the ladder, the one who's always given the flowers to eat. I am that person. But we have ate dahlias. We've ate dahlia tubers on air and turned them into chips before.
Yeah, but you're still alive. What are you moaning about?
Tom, I'm getting the sense that they have a bit more of an adventurous life than maybe our podcasting life, sitting in our homes on Zoom. I think we need to be...
They're in touch with the natural world, whereas me and you stuck inside.
Yeah. But we're out here in all weathers, you know. People think allotments are for just for summer, and there are allotmenteers that you'll see. You don't see until the start of the year, but we're literally year-round people, and we've been here in the snow, in the rain, in the hail, and, you know, keep on going, because there's always something to do on the plots, and everything is recycled. Everything.
Except tea. She'll put the kettle on in a minute.
So, Julia, it's taken me around to the various areas of the allotment.
I just want to show you our flower area. Elaine and I absolutely love flowers, and it is very ordered and manicured in some respects. And we're very conscious of wildlife, and I think a lot of it is presented, we've got to go wild now. And I think a lot of gardeners are a little bit resistant about that. So are we right to do this? Because everything that we buy and plant is meant to be wildlife friendly. So
I think you're just excited to grow. So whether you like something more manicured or you like something more wild, you could do either, or you could do something in between, which is a bit what you've done here, which is really, really beautiful. And it looks like you can see the pollinators. And what other wildlife do you get here?
We get pretty much everything. We've got little hedgehogs that walk through. We've got hoverflies, bees, wasps. I don't know all the insects by name, to be honest with you, but we have all kinds of birds on site. We have badgers on site. We have foxes on site. So, you know, it is a real haven for wildlife. But I think a lot of people feel like they've got to do a lot, but actually, you know, in just introducing something, I suppose. We like to give our flowers away as well, because we think it makes people happy.
Yeah, very nice to see all the flowers here. And I think if we look as well, the UK landscape isn't natural. And if we just leave things to go wild, there's all sorts of invasive species which take over. Yeah. And actually, this management process is an important part of it to make sure we keep the good things in and take some of the bad things out. Because otherwise, a few things just go wild.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, in terms of growing our flowers as well, we're conscious. Again, we like to take flowers home. We like to give them away. But we're conscious that, is it something like 80% of flowers in the UK bought flowers that come from abroad? So it's kind of, you know, we're doing something for the planet, aren't we?
I think you're absolutely right. And if you can grow flowers and harvest them, and there are a few in Derbyshire and Staffordshire that actually grow most of their own flowers, florists, I should say, that grow most of their own flowers on their actual property. So if you can do that yourself in your own garden or use a florist that does that, I think it's really valuable.
And the other thing as well is most of the flowers we buy in shops come from energy intensive farms, right, where they're indoors, they pump up the heat, using lots of processes, lots of fossil fuels. Reality is, your stuff out here is just out in the wild.
Yes.
No inputs here, there's no electricity being used to keep this stuff on.
So. No, it is seasonal. It's all seasonal.
It's a win-win for the environment, for our pollinators, and for your friends as well.
Brilliant. Now, the next thing I was a bit concerned about, I thought, oh, you might kind of, oh, I don't know what you'd do to me, but I'm using a plastic polytunnel here. Now, this, I was saying to PK earlier, has got, the cover has got a lifespan of 7 to 10 years. So is that a good thing? Because I can grow in this a lot longer than outside.
I actually think it's a great thing. And we talk about plastic. It's not that plastic is necessarily the enemy. It's the fact that we use it so much and just throw it away, and we can't recycle everything we throw away. But using something like this that lasts, like you said, many, many years, and it's helping you to grow food, that's a much more responsible way to do it. And of course, it does lengthen the food growing season, which means you're getting food at a ripe peakness. It's not having to be imported. So I think it's an excellent way. What about you, Tom?
Definitely. And I think it comes down to something that we talk about all the time. We boil down complex questions into yes or no answers. And actually, there's a good balance to be made here. And you can repair this. Easy, job done, without having to get something whole new put together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keep away from canes in the polytunnel. If you use canes, you'll poke a hole in it. But it's always good to have some repair tape. So as you can see, I'm growing all kinds of things. The tomatoes are kind of coming over now. We're coming to the last lot of the tomatoes. And I've got the peppers growing here. So it is something that I do use year round. So as things are coming out, we're now looking at replacing them with other things. So I love my polytunnel. Once you've had a polytunnel, you never go back.
I am jealous, and I can already see jobs for my husband. Gorgeous tomatoes growing still. The last of them, I think you said, you've got your peppers coming in, and you've got interspersed marigolds as well. And why is that?
The marigold is a companion plant, so it will actually deter the white fly. So it's a great thing to have in here. And of course, we save the seeds at the end of the year, so they're all going over, and then we just spread them around and share them with our friends. So, but it also looks very jolly, doesn't it?
I can also see in the soil a few banana skins kicking about the place. Have you been hungry?
Yes. So I use the banana skins to actually ripen the tomatoes earlier in the season, because a lot of people will say they don't ripen very quickly, whereas obviously that emits the gases that then help with the ripening process. While I've got you in here, I just want you to note that this side is no dig and this side is dig. So we do experiments on the plot, and for the last couple of years, I've been growing no dig outside and dig on one side, and we've also followed it in the polytunnel. So do you know anything about no dig gardening?
I do. It's exciting, and you can trap loads of carbon in the ground by doing no dig.
Right.
And I think when we start to think about the environmental impact of the things that we're doing, and obviously a lot of agricultural practice nowadays, we get most of our food is just intensive, we're ripping up soil, and then there's so much carbon that goes into the atmosphere as a result of it. No dig's an exciting way to see how things are going.
It really is. And there's a lot of kind of progress in that. And we were talking to a lovely guy from an allotment site in Bath. They're starting the first no-dig allotment sites that are now spreading throughout the country. And I think it is the way forward, because it does save a lot of work.
the thing to think about here is that you're experimenting, and our listeners can experiment as well. So they can do the same thing you've done. You're in the exact same environment, and just a couple feet away or a couple meters away, you're doing a no dig with your tomatoes and your marigolds. And then over here, you're doing dig, yeah. and you're seeing what works best for you.
Yeah.
And the amount of work, I think, is really impressive to save some time.
Yes. And I think the thing to note is that I've never had a lesser crop in the no dig, but I've also had less weeds, which is really important. Now, this area outside, we did on our podcast a couple of months ago, and it's now come to fruition. We love our horse, Mucky Lane, and I do. And so we've got these beds at the front that we've got nothing in, and we just loaded them with fresh horse muck and whacked some squash plants in. And as you can see, they've gone fantastically well. And I love a squash plant. I don't know if you've ever grown them.
I have, actually. I've did it on a community-supported agriculture group. Haven't been able to do it at the house, but it looks like if I got some horse muck, I could maybe have a bumper crop.
Literally, all you need is horse muck. We've got bags of horse muck. It's delivered by the muck man, and we have planted squash plants in the muck in the bag itself because they are really, really hungry plants, so they like the nutrients in there. They like the moisture. So, I mean, look at all this and this. The size of these squash, these are Crown Prince, which are absolutely beautiful if you've not had them before. Taste like a butternut squash. And they will keep us going for months over the Hungry Gap.
They're just gorgeous.
Now, the big thing about the no dig, obviously, composting. That is the big thing about no dig, is the fact that you need loads of compost. So as you can see, I've got composters and I've been trialling different ones. And I think that's important that people try something that suits them, because the Dalek ones, I've not found them suit me as much. This is my favourite. Have you ever seen one of these?
I've never seen one ever. That looks nifty.
That is fantastic. So it's a turning bin, but it's my height.
And they are actually better for the environment as well in terms of the amount of carbon emissions that come from them.
What, one of these ones?
Yeah. So when you have normal compost, because yeah. you're taking the oxygen out of the environment, methane is released. And methane is a really, really potent greenhouse gas. So that one, because you'll be spinning it, you'll yeah. be moving the oxygen around and reoxygenating the compost that's in there, enabling it to break down into carbon dioxide, which is much less potent as a greenhouse gas.
When you say a normal compost, do you mean the open compost bins? The ones
Even those ones there.
Oh, really? Now then, while we're on that one. So this is a hot bin, much coveted. I love my hot bin. Makes compost much quicker. But is that better for the environment, or is that a bad one?
Why not?
I love my composting.
You've done something miraculous, Julie. You've stumped Tom. and that is something, because we consider him our Wikipedia, basically, our Tomopedia. So it's something we might have to look up. Now, the one that you're showing us, which yes. is your hot compost.
Yeah.
Is it just plant matter you put in there? Or can you? Because I've seen compost. Like my husband, he said a long time ago, they had one where he could put their meat scraps in there as well.
Everything can go in that. Everything can go in the hot bin. And everything, I don't know if you noticed on the table over there, it's only because I'm taking it home, but I've got a bokashi bin. Has anyone done bokashi compost?
I've just been gifted one. Somebody couldn't deal with it, and I said, I'll take it.
Yeah, so bokashi and the hot bin, you can actually put bones, you can put any cooked kitchen scraps in, anything, because of the way that it processes. So that there's no air in it, and obviously it composts everything down much, much quicker.
And how long does it take?
A hot bin, that will take about 3 months to get the good quality compost out.
That is much quicker than I thought. So yeah. I can see another project for my husband in the future.
And as a compost novice,
yeah.
why is it called a hot bin?
Because it gets the heat up in there. So it literally will burn everything in there because it's insulated. And the way that you feed it, and it gets very, very hot. So you can even put things like perennial weeds in. You can put things that have gone into seed, which you wouldn't be putting in your normal compost bin, because otherwise that would just be going back onto your plot. So I love it.
It's beautiful.
So this is, yeah, again, you know, about you saying about using chemicals and things to keep pests and problems off, what we use a lot of is netting, which you don't tend to see in the gardening programs.
No, that's true. But I've I've done it with and without, and I've done it with the companion planting of the marigolds. The marigolds definitely make a difference. I can tell that. But I know there are certain plants I need to be netting because I never get to harvest. And your plants are covered in a net, yeah. And they look glorious. And you're definitely going to be able to harvest what you've grown.
Yeah, and this isn't actual gardener's netting. This is netting that's come from a building yard that we've just had off a builder that when we stop them, we say, can we have some of that debris netting that you've got there? So, you know, always looking for something that can be reused in a different way.
And it's also the fact that actually, because things are growing, the nutrient cycling is working with the soil better, everything is working more in unison. And rather than just things disappearing, taking some stuff out to grow, but then not being able to give anything back later on.
Brilliant. Will you take one of these heads away with you?
Oh, yes, I will, darling.
So, PK and I spend an awful lot of time thinking about climate change and the impacts of climate change.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything here on the allotment? Can you notice the world changing being here year on year on year?
We've definitely noticed that there are longer, drier periods. And also when the rains come, they do come and we have it for a more prolonged period. We have flooding issues anyway on this site. And although it sometimes benefits us, because obviously if you've got a high water table, it can be a benefit. Sometimes it does mean that we can't get on the plots until much later in the year.
And how do you prepare for that? How do you think about it in the future?
It's about thinking around the problem. So in terms of planting where you know that you've got a particular area that floods or we've got, you know, it is going to flood, I wouldn't necessarily be planting any winter crops in that area. So work around the problem. Anything that I know is going to be water intensive, then, in terms of a thirsty plant, I will plant there. In a wet area that I know is going to be wet. Obviously, we're saving a lot more water if we can save water. It's just thinking about it. And we're also building upwards. So we're doing a lot more raised beds on site because, and also that actually means that the ground is warmer. So you can plant a little bit earlier as well.
Thank you so much, Julia, for the tour of the garden and all those useful tips that are eco-friendly and also food-growing friendly. And now I think we're going to go back to the beer garden where I'm smelling some amazing aromas because I think Elaine's been cooking something for us.
Yes, she has.
Well, good of you to come back, Julia, because I've been busy cooking while you've been talking and walking round.
Have you finished?
I've just got a mouthful of cucumber, but I've got rid of that now.
Yeah.
So, I have finished. And what I've done is I've used the vegetables off the plot. Mm-hmm. So I've used onions, potatoes, chard, which people think is sometimes rhubarb. It's really not. And then I've added chilies and your red peppers, actually. Yeah. And then I've added cumin seeds, turmeric, sugar, salt and a little tiny bit of...
gram flour?
Yeah, well, it isn't a little tiny bit, really. No. It was about, well, I don't know, because I was going to say in grams, and you know, I can't do that. No. So it's a couple of handfuls. That's what I've done.
Yeah.
And then what you do is you mix it all round and leave it, and something magical happens because then the moisture is drawn out and it makes this batter stuff. And then all you have to do is fry it. And that's what I've done while you've been just walking and talking. I've added no dahlias.
No, well, good.
Okay.
Right, okay.
And I've actually sliced up some beefsteak tomatoes and cucumber. Can I say the cucumber's delicious, Julia?
Thank you very much.
Indeed.
I can concur. I was tasting those cucumbers and I thought, these are some of the best tasting cucumbers I've ever had.
Oh, have you paid her while you've been going?
No, not paid her.
And I'm going to comment on these amazing, we call them fritters in the United States, but these deep fried, gorgeous, garden fresh vegetables are glorious, and if you could see them, they're so beautiful. They should be on Waitrose front cover next month.
Oh, if you could write to them, PK, please.
Yes. Hashtag Waitrose front cover.
I've got to say, I was a bit anxious when I've been told there was food on the way after just seeing mountains of chilies, thinking you're going to sit us down and we have to do a chili challenge. But I've been pleasantly surprised by some absolutely amazing pecoras. Yeah.
Can we just ask how many food miles have we used doing the cooking?
A quarter of a mile, I think, the footsteps that have come around this allotment here. So.
So low mileage, low carbon footprint for the distance this food had to come. Very low carbon in terms of how it was grown. And really, really high peak of nutrition because you're picking them right when they're ripe, right off the vine. So I think this is the best you could do in terms of mileage and nutrient density.
Elaine would like everybody to have an allotment. What do you think about that then?
I think it's a great place to start. And all of a sudden, you bring these together, the communities, the wildlife, and just a nice place to be.
The community is one of the most important things that comes out of allotments, which says how you two met. Isn't that correct?
That's how we met. Yes. And there's only Elaine that will get excited by a large cucumber like I do.
Yeah. So we think the allotments, for a variety of reasons, but it's also a way to use up space around cities and towns that aren't necessarily being used for anything else. Brown spaces, turn them green, get people together, get people growing food and understanding where their food comes from, and then doing a lot of good work for pollinators as well.
And after losing my allotment virginity, I've got to say I'll be back around too soon.
You think that gate locked, Jimmy?
It's been one of the most exciting Ecocentrics podcasts, so thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week.
Bye!